I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and you're about to hear TechNet number 1716. Pretty soon you'll be hearing Space Report number 316. And you'll also be hearing Science Talk number 45 from Roy, AC2GS. The Space Report is from Paul, WS2N. As you can tell, the TechNet is broken up into approximately three sections. Not always evenly divided. Depends on your enthusiasm. Let me drop. The TechNet primarily is a gathering of the clan of radio amateurs, or at least people who want to be radio amateurs, people who have a curiosity about wireless techniques in general. So we try to teach each other how wireless equipment works. The classes do a mediocre job, the books do a mediocre job of teaching that. You're going to really know how transmitters and transmission lines and antennas and receivers really work. The best thing you can do is talk to an experienced radio amateur who's actually touched it, fiddled with it, and lived with it for lots of his life. So there's an awful lot to be learned. One of the complaints that happens occasionally with the TechNet, because this is the 36th year, 1982 until now, 36 years. So for 36 years, 1,716 TechNet. That amount of time, that number of going to occasionally hear, you're going to occasionally hear duplications. You're going to say, gee, I've heard that subject before. I mean, with 1,700 TechNets, you can't have 1,700 times 3 hours, so to speak, worth of completely unique equipment. So you're going to see partial repetition. I say partial. I mean, we may have talked about a dipole antenna last week, and we're going to talk about a dipole antenna this week. But quite possibly, it'll be a different method of feeding it, a different method of impedance matching, a different altitude above the ground, different polarization, different frequency band. A dipole on 10 gigs and a dipole on 80 meters is a very different looking antenna. A dipole on 10 gigahertz is 1/2 inch.
Repeater, timeout.
A 10 gigahertz dipole is 1/2 inch, tip to tip. A quarter wave ground plane on 10 gigs is 1/4 inch high. And that gives you the full gain on 10 gigs of 2.14 dB over isotropic. Ain't that crazy? And I have used, as an antenna, you know what an SMA connector looks like. The center conductor of an SMA connector is essentially flush with the rest of the surface of the connector. That center pin sticks out 3/16 of an inch or so from the Teflon washer. I have used that as an antenna and communicated on 10 gigs to a person 10 miles away through the trees using milliwatts of power. So RF is strange stuff, as you can tell. Let me drop. And you can run your QRP rig, your low power rig, running 5 watts or even less on the CW band of 80 meters or 40 meters, and under the right band conditions, the right part of the sunspot cycle, you press down that key, and a guy 12,000 miles away in Japan hears you sending real action at a distance. How in the world does that radio signal do that? Kind of amazing. Or you can be talking to a repeater. It's directly behind that water tower that's very close to your house. How in the world does that signal wrap around that water tower and get there? As far as that signal is concerned, that water tower on 2 meters could, in some cases, be essentially transparent and even give you a little bit of gain. There's a law of antenna, what's it now called? Radar cross-section. It sort of explains it. Bistatic radar cross-section. So, the number of terms that are used in radio is huge. Let me drop. We teach each other those terms. So be careful not to prejudge because you say to yourself, gee, I've heard that subject before. Well, that's just one of 10 subjects we covered during any one particular TechNet, maybe 20 or 30 subjects, now that we've got two other guys supplying subjects, not just me. The first section of the TechNet is where people sign in with their call letters and name after waiting for the four beeps. Lots of people will pick up the mic real fast, start talking, then squeeze. We miss some of the words because the repeater doesn't pick up that rapidly. And so you're going to sign in with your call letters and name. And the word yes means you do have a question or a comment. So the question and answer section is the first section of the TechMed. Let me drop. After 36 years of TechMeds, you don't have to sign in saying you're listening and congratulate us. Not required. After 36 years, we believe somebody is listening. By way of IRL, and Echo Link, people from very long distances sometimes are signing into the TechMed. For those who want to hear past TechNet, or if you don't have the ability to stay up so late, like Joe doesn't have the ability to stay up so late, he could go to the website where it all gets recorded and played back a couple of days later. The last 11 years of TechNet are recorded at amateurradio.tangovictor. The website is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And that's by mic number one. Mic number two. Has another website, which is bymarktechnet.com, which has other supporting material for the TechNet. By that I mean it's got graphs and you hear me talk about the Brown and Woodward curves quite often. In fact, you can find those on both of those websites. Okay, at this time, you guys are going to give me your call letters and your name because you're checking in because you do have a question or a comment. I've already got Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. Who's the next person who would like to sign in? Call letters and name after the beeps right now, please.
This is Delta Papa Zulu with a comment.
And here we go. Which is about the ballot.
This is DBZ with a comment.
Okay, we have Joe and Rich. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and name after the beeps right now.
The duck with a comment. K6DP.
Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name right now if you do want to check into the TechNet. K2LIW listening.
Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Bravo Uniform, Dan.
Was that Kilo Delta or Kilo Bravo 2? I think you said Kilo Delta 2, Foxtrot Bravo Uniform. Is that true, Dan?
That's correct.
Okay. Can't read my own writing. Got more than enough to get going. Joe, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, how are those electrons on the South Shore treating you tonight? And as you know, I make a joke about that. The electrons rattle back and forth in the antenna when you're transmitting or receiving. But when you're transmitting, none of those electrons leave the antenna. Ain't that crazy? Over to you, Joe, K2LAW.
Well, good evening, Dick. How are you? This is really not a question. It's more of a, I'll just throw it out to the net in general, and you too. I'm looking for a professional-grade desoldering station. Maybe people on the net have used it at some time, and they can suggest something that's worthwhile in pursuing. Back to you. Looking for a good professional grade desoldering station.
And I can tell you're listening to what's being said back on the repeater and you know when you're getting through. Well done. There is running full duplex, I can tell. One of the guys who I know has a very good desoldering station is Eric, KE2EJ. If I know him, he's got a commercial grade one, which is $1 zillion, but First, turn it over to Eric, and after Eric tells us what he's using, anybody else who has a desoldering station that does a good job and you're happy with it, be ready to tell us what you have found and what it costs after Eric. KE2EJ, if you're available on that particular question, K2IW. Go ahead, Eric.
K2IW, KE2EJ. Well, are we talking about a rework station for doing service mount stuff or just a desoldering station? Anyway, if you want to go cheap, there's a Chinese manufacturer. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it on eBay. And also, the main distributors in Massachusetts. It's called Aoyu.
It's the A-O-Y-U-E. And you can get a rework station, which includes a hot air decide of it, plus a vacuum decide of it, for under like $150. It's cheap compared to many of the others. There's companies called Pace and Weller and I can't think of the other big one. But anyway, the AOE has a number of different products. If you're going for a rework, or you're just going for a physical desoldering station with soldering irons. So, back to you, to K2RW, K2, yeah.
Okay, that call, Sue.
You heard Kilo Golf Zulu. We'll pick you up in a minute. First, Joe, do you need any fills on some of the stuff that Eric just gave you quite rapidly? To B2RYY, K2RIW, go ahead, Joe.
Well, the other company's name is HAKO, H-A-K-O.
You got it, Joe.
I can always rewind the tape and play it back if I miss something. good for the guy recording all this stuff. No, I think I got that. Eric, what do you use? I know that you said there's a cheap brand, but what do you use yourself, and how long have you had it, and how would you rate it as far as performance-wise?
Yeah, the one that I have, I think it's about 8 years old, 9 years old. They have re-engineered it with better components. I have an older version of the desoldering unit. They've come out with a newer version of it that's a little easier to keep clean. But it's fabulous. They also make tong soldering irons. Basically, it's two soldering irons you put on either side of a surface mount device and use it up and lift it out. I actually love it. It's fabulous. It's got the pump built in. It has filters so you can maintain it and keep it clean, and it works quite well. And the hot air blaster, you can control the amount of pressure and the volume of air going through it. It's got a ball gauge on it so you can see what you're doing.
I missed the name of what you said it was. Repeat that again.
I'll give it to you phonetically. It's actually a Chinese word. It's Alpha Ontario Yokohama Uniform Echo.
Okay, you use a Chinese brand. Okay, so I know there are different makes, like Weller probably makes it, Pace probably makes it. I've heard of a couple of different names. I'm not sure how many others are out there. I was wondering what you use. So you use a like an offbeat type of brand. I guess you're happy with it and performs well.
Yeah, the HAKO works well. It's more expensive. The Pace works well. That's also more expensive. That's American made. Weller, of course. I think the one with the pump is like $300 and change. I bought this because it was cheap, and all of a sudden I became very happy with it. One thing I will say, if you're doing surface mount rework, it's not the device, it's skill. It's the ability to know what's enough heat, how much air pressure to blow on something, because if you're using a solder paste, you use too much air pressure, it blows a little solder balls all over the place. You know, it's something you got to practice a little bit to get it right, so to speak. And it also depends upon the type of PC board you're working on and the size of the component. It's all different. I mean, when I build something, I basically use a toaster oven with a little microprocessor that follows the heat cycle for any given set of components. And, you know, that's when you're building a board and you put all the pieces down and then you heat it up and then you have a started board.
It's funny, VHF is signals degrading. I'm not sure what happened here. I can hear something else in the background, too. Anyway, okay. I will be using it for portable radio work. I do that on the side from time to time, and it's becoming increasingly difficult to try to do with a hand desoldering tool with a Weller, TC201. I have to think about going a little further than that because some of the repairs become very time-consuming to try to do it the hard way, so to speak. That's why I forgot to bring up the question. And somebody else was out there that may have had a comment on this also. So, Dick, back to you, then over to the next guy that had a comment on this subject.
Yeah, quite possibly that is Bill, WB2QGZ, who has done an awful lot of rework of exotic pieces of electronics in his day. And pretty sure that was you, Bill, WB2QGZ, B2RAW. Go right ahead.
Hey, good evening. So, real quick, the I have an that same brand as Eric, the AOYUE, however you say it. Reworks, a high rework station with the soldering iron. Kind of came with it in the package. Works pretty good. Most of my, or a lot of my service mount rework is, let's make that noise, we'll make it stop. Most of my service mount rework I do with that, it works pretty well. For through-hole components, I have about an 8-year-old PACE device. I got, bought it in Dayton, probably cost about $400. That's hard to beat for service mount stuff in my experience, but Eric may have some experience with the Chinese manufacturer through-hole vacuum pump, and that may work good. But the PACE works for me. The rework station, the same brand as Eric's, works good for me. I've done a lot of stuff with it. The only thing I'll say is if you're, you know, you're doing a lot of rework, sometimes you need to preheat the board, you know, either in a toaster oven or some kind of preheating device in order to, you have to kind of hit this spot where you're able to heat the components up, either melt the solder paste or melt what's there to pull the piece up, and doing it on a cold board with the hot air tip alone is sometimes kind of challenging. The preheated board, which takes the board to maybe 120 or 140 degrees, you add a little bit of extra hot air out of the tip, and it becomes a little bit easier to work with if you're doing surface mount stuff. Back to net, WB2QGZ.
I agree completely. I have a what's called a preheater by the same company, and it works quite well.
So back to Eric first as to what's the price of the preheater, and then I'm going to go over to Bill as to what brand of preheater he uses. Eric first. Go ahead, Eric.
That's the LG, and I think the preheater was like $60 or $50, but that was a few years ago. I don't expect it to be any more expensive. You can actually control the temperature, which you place the board on top of it, and it warms up the board to actually, if you look up the temperature values of any given component, you can average it out across what's in the board, and it makes desoldering really easy, and also prevents you from shocking the components. The components actually have a temperature curve. And the idea is to get it to a certain point where you can now hit it with the high intensity, the air blasting heat, and you don't damage anything. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Eric. And after the beeps, Bill, what do you use as a preheater? A tiny little toaster oven? I'm having a joke. Over to you, Bill.
Yeah, don't laugh. I have a little hot plate. I shoot it with a non-contact IR thermometer. And I'll typically set it, I'll get it to the point where it's about 120-ish. Somewhere between 120 and 140 is my seat of the pants number, and that works pretty good for me. When I was originally looking at the preheaters, they were much more expensive, and I don't think the place that Eric talked about had anything available at that time. But I would certainly be in for the $60 for a real live temperature-controlled preheater. Like Eric's talking about, but you know, you have a couple of options.
Your infrared thermometer. What brand name? Roughly how many dollars is that these days? Bill, go ahead.
Oh, it's like a Lowe's or a Home Despot thing, and it's probably under $20.
Oh, amazing! Our technology has come a long way. That instrument. Some number of years ago, it was a ridiculously high price. Anyone with any further questions or comments on the subject of solder rework stations, desoldering stations, and so on, in order to rework printed circuit boards with the fancy chips on them. Give me a call at us right now if you need further information or want to give us information. K2LAW and the TechNet listening. Yeah, thank you, Joe. That's a good subject. And when it comes to repeating subjects, the last time we talked about desoldering, I bet you if I check back on the recordings, we probably haven't discussed that subject for 5 or 8 years. Yes? If you had signed into the TechNet 8 years ago, you're going to say, yeah, I've heard that one before. Well, probably haven't heard the latest brand names or the latest prices. Okay, Rich is next, N2EO. And Balans, I started studying Balans last night. When you go to 4-to-1 Balans, you just Google that word. You get a zillion pictures of these Balans. They give you a whole bunch of pictures, schematic diagrams, physical diagrams. Let me drop. And some of the ones that are listed under 4-to-1, when you actually study them, they're not 4-to-1. Sometimes they're 2-to-1, sometimes they're 9-to-1. A Balan that gives you a patch must, by definition, give you a voltage doubling. So if you put 1 volt of RF into it, 2 volts comes out in a balanced manner. So at one instant of time, the right side is +1 and the left side is -1, even though you're putting in only 1 volt with a piece of coax cable. So Balans are highly misunderstood and very, very useful devices. So let's see what Rich is going to ask us about Balans. N2EO, K2LAW, go ahead, Rich.
N2EO, I was in bed last night listening to the conversation between you and Annie. Annie can't figure it out. The whole situation, very macabre. Said to me that today, he said to me that he used a network analyzer, 100% of the power is coming back. And I don't know what happened, because the last time I used the radio on 40 meters, everything was working fine. And then reset. Anyway, a few days later, I keyed up in all hell broke loose. The tuner was where I left it. Everything was fine. That's when the plate melted off the tuner. And, by the way, an interesting thing. I'd never brought up. That little thing with the two bulbs to see that the line is balanced. Remember how it came up with the idea? Well, when I keyed up, only one of the bulbs was lit. One side of the open wire line. Shortly later, that one failed too.
When you were using your 100-watt transceiver rig, feeding I think it's an Armatron amplifier, I believe you use, into an antenna tuner, into the Balan, and into a Cobra antenna, Cobra dipole antenna, what's the highest power that you believe you've ever run the amplifier at, Rich? Make a guess. Was it possibly 1,500 watts key down? Over to you, N2EO, K2LAW.
Correct, Dick. It's not an Ameritron. It's a Henley. 2K. Compare 3-500Z. I could put out a full 1,500 watts.
And I'm not sure that the Balan you're using is rated for 1,500 watts. So that could be a contributing factor. It may only be rated for 1,200. Now, a device running 1,200 watts, being hit with 1,500 watts of peak envelope power sideband, shouldn't be a problem. But right now, with the evidence we've got, there is something wrong with the Balan, which is presenting a high standing wave ratio. One of the tests that Andy did is he plugged 10 watts into the Balan on the 50-ohm input connector. The 200-ohm balanced output connector, he put a high power 200-ohm load resistor on it. and hopefully he has tested that resistor with a good ohmmeter or some other technique. And under those conditions, there should have been 10 watts flowing forward. All the power going through the balance should have gone to the 200 ohm resistor and nothing come back. And what Andy saw was 10 watts going forward and very close to 10 watts coming back. That reflected power from the balance made all of us at first think that the antenna had failed, and that we now have evidence to believe that maybe the Cobra antenna is a hunky-dory. It's already had a nice, close visual inspection by Andy climbing up on the roof and seeing it and touching it. That high standing wave ratio of the balun, let me drop this.
This is DBZ with a comment.
That high reflected power of the balun came back to the amplifier, at correction of the antenna tuner, I should have mentioned. Damaged the antenna tuner's vis warranted technic circuit, blew out its diode, damaged one of its capacitors, one of its resistors, and then the output tuning capacitor on the antenna tuner also arced over and become damaged. Now, Mr. Lou Civic, I think his name is, W2FMI, had a whole series of articles in QST Magazine 15 or so years ago, 20 years ago, on electrically small dipole and monopole antennas, ground plane, electrically small monopole antennas to be used in someone's backyard. Had a whole series of articles on those, and the articles gave you three very good pieces of information. Let me drop.
A6DPZ with a comment.
The three pieces of information were how small the antenna could be. He was shrinking them down in size, and depending on the amount of ground plane radials, he was getting different amounts of efficiency and measuring that. He also was using various kinds of Grunella and Ruff-Ruff balans and telling you lots of characteristics of the balun. In fact, one of the characteristics he told us is that certain kinds of balans, when overloaded, when given higher than normal power, you get a permanent change to the chemistry of the ferrite or powdered iron. In other words, the toroid, the iron material, the magnetic material that's in the balun can be damaged and give you a permanent change in the characteristics of the balun when overloaded. That was one of the things that Mr. Civic, W2FMI, brought to our attention. He's now a silent key, by the way. And he and I were on the same lecture circuit on one particular time at an AR Orel event. Let me drop. So he was showing us how short the antenna could be. In front of one of his antennas, it was made into a kind of an umbrella and had his wife sitting in a beach chair under that umbrella alongside of that antenna when it was not transmitting. So how small could the antenna be and still be very efficient? How many ground plane radios gave you what kind of efficiency? What kind of balance to be used with various kinds of antennas? So that article had a lot of good information. So right now, Andy is doing a step-by-step divide and conquer to find out what in the world is going on with that balun. I think he was, one of the tests I was hearing yesterday he was about to do is to sweep it with his vector network analyzer, assuming that there was a frequency selective characteristic of some kind. The balun itself is supposed to work on 80 through 10 meters and maybe even 80 through 6 meters when it's working correctly. So I wasn't listening today, and I think you're saying, Rich, that Andy gave us further information today on his further testing. I'll first turn it over to Andy if he's there and we can get the information from the horse's mouth. W2CDL, if you're within earshot, Andy. KQI, W the TechNet. So what did your balun testing show us today, Andy? Go ahead.
A6DPZ. Come on, you let me in a minute.
N2H2H with a comment.
A6DPZ with a comment.
N2HUH recognized. Let me give one more call to Andy. W2CDL, Andy, are you available? KQRIW on the TechNet.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Okay, N2HUH, go right ahead, sir.
Good evening, Dick, into the net. And my limited experience with balance, I come to a conclusion, just as you mentioned, with the ferrite core, saturation points, and permeabilities, and if you're not using a resonant antenna, I don't care if it's a Balun, an Un-Un, there's so many unforeseen variables. If I'm going to use a 1500 watt toroid style Balun, Un-Un, doesn't matter, I want it rated for 3000 to 5000 watts. And because once you damage that core, the toroid, or changes characteristics somehow, it's basically useless, or it's not, that isn't there anymore. So I don't like leaving anything to chance. I definitely like and definitely would suggest a better rated Balun, 2 or 3 times the output power. And that's for current arcing and covering all the bases. Go ahead, Dick, N2HOH. Andy here.
K6DPZ with a comment.
Yeah, very fine, Andy. You're a very conservative guy. You want to make sure that your Balun is rated for the right amount of power. And whether or not this Balun was damaged, being hit by high power and permanently changed, is something still to be reviewed by Andy. The kind of Balun he's using, as I said, is a 4-to-1 impedance ratio, 2-to-1 voltage ratio. It's the kind that's made with two separate toroids. Andy, one of the experiments Andy did was to unwire each of the toroids and measure their inductance.
Repeater, timeout.
He measured their inductance, and he measured 89 microhenries. That's a very popular value for inductors, toroid inductors, 89 microhenries. The fact that he measured 89 microhenries, which, by the way, at 20 meters is something like a few thousand ohms of inductive reactance. So it doesn't appear as though a complete failure of the ferrite has occurred. Otherwise, I don't think he would have measured 89 microhenries. And by the way, one of the next steps we can do is he knows how many turns he's got of wire on that toroid. By hook or by crook, he can find out what kind of ferrite or powdered iron, what kind of material is the toroid, and therefore there's ways of predicting that number of turns on that toroid, probably by the way the manufacturer, you know exactly how many microhenries it's supposed to present. So last I know, Andy was still doing some divide and conquer on that Balun. Sounds like Andy is not available tonight. I'm going to give one more test for, one more standby for Andy WA2CDL. WA2CDL, if you're there, Andy, KQRIW on the TechNet.
He says GPZ with a comment. Dick, why are you letting me in? Is the boss going to bite your hand?
Okay, so let's go back to Rich. I think you said you did hear from Andy on the air today as to further testing. And what do you remember CDL saying? N2EO, K2LIW. Go ahead, Rich.
He says GPZ. No, okay, instead he's starting a new job tomorrow. He may be now on tonight. You guys were talking last night. It's hard to believe that lightning strikes may have created...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Security comes in. I think that's what I'm going to buy.
Yeah, you picked up before waiting for the beeps, and some of that timed out. You were continuing to come out of the 975, 375 repeater, the cellular repeater, but we lost you on this particular repeater. Let me think now. So, yes, a lightning strike did occur, and so that's a contributing factor to a possible Balun failure. So Andy has to get up early tomorrow, so therefore he's not on tonight with us, quite possibly. So, it looks like the continuing saga of the apparent Balun failure. I mean, when you look at this Balun, it's got two toroids and a few turns of wire around those toroids. And certain wiring, I think it's a 14-gauge or 12-gauge wire, Teflon-insulated wire. And you gave a good hard visual inspection. The wire looks good, no shorted turns, no arcing and sparking anywhere, no smoke and flames. The connectors all look good. So how can something look so good, individual toroids measure 89 microhenries, and still not do the function? We'll eventually find out. It's a continuing saga. But it looks like maybe the lightning strike damaged the toroid, and that set this whole series of motions in action. Let me drop. Where Rich suffered high standing wave ratio, damage to the output tuning capacitor on the antenna tuner, damage to a number of components in the standing wave ratio detecting circuit of the output circuit of the antenna tuner. So it's amazing how many things can happen. Most ham radio accidents occur with one single failure. Got quite a cascade of failures in this particular incident. We'll soon find out more about it. So ham radio operators really enjoy doing troubleshooting. I can tell Andy's having a good time with this one. Rich is not quite as happy because he'd like his rig back on the air in a hurry, but at least progress is being made. I mean, it took a while to find out these individual components. I mean, when the standing wave ratio circuit, where for a while Rich was reporting to us that the forward power or the reverse power would peg the needle, and the other needle was not moving at all. And that was a strong indication that something had failed in that circuit, because there's no way you can have zero power reflected with some power going forward, or vice versa, power reflected and nothing going forward. So we knew the circuit was fibbing to us. Going to go over to the next person was Dan. Kilo Bravo 2, Foxtrot Bravo Uniform. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Dan. K2LAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Kilo Bravo 2, Foxtrot Bravo Uniform, if I got your call correct. Go right ahead, Dan. K2LAW. Dan's in Poughkeepsie, New York. And maybe for some reason the signal is not coming in from Poughkeepsie. I'm going to try listening to him directly on the input. KB2, FBU, K2LAW, go ahead, Dan. Okay, who is that? I just heard something, too. Give me your full call and name after the beeps. K2LAW in the TechNet. Who is the person who just tried giving us a call? Okay. While we're waiting for Dan to come back, is there anyone else listening to the TechNet that has a question or a comment they would like to give us? Give us your call letters and name right now. It could be a late sign-in, so to speak. KQRIW on the TechNet.
NY2H.
Lou, we're awful glad to hear from you. NY2H, K2LAW. You sound very good tonight out there on the eastern end of Long Island.
Hey, good evening. Just wondering if you're going to pick up on that topic again at all tonight, or maybe Roy is on the Havana microwave incident.
Yeah, what Lou is referring to, and was brought to our attention last week, is that the U.S. agents in Havana, Cuba, I believe it was Cuba, and also in China, have been experiencing a health problem which has the characteristics of ultrasonic high-power noise being heard in the ears, or microwave energy, where the people are developing headaches and difficulty concentrating and lack of hearing, and some of the symptoms look like a brain injury, as if a concussion had occurred. So is some kind of fancy equipment being used that's making our agents is not the right word, but you know what I mean, people who are in a foreign embassy, they're experiencing these degrees of difficulty. Let me drop. In both the embassy and in their hotel of residence, in both places, they're experiencing these medical conditions. And so the U.S. asked most of those people to come back home, and is suggesting that even tourists not go there for the time being until this is further researched. You probably have better information on it than I do. I don't have that article in front of me right now, so I'll turn it over to you. And I know that a number of New York Times articles, a number of Journal of American Medical Association. There's been a whole series of articles on this thing. There's probably 10 or 15 articles in various journals describing this condition right now. NY2H, for anything you want to tell us about this, take your time, Lou. K2RIW. Wait for the beeps.
So, in full disclosure, we had some emails back and forth, you and myself, Roy and Paul. So when Roy comes on, actually, or maybe he wants to jump in now, I don't know. He's got a healthy skepticism about the reports of perhaps a microwave connection. And he, being a physician, he's got also a great insight into to some of the medical findings. Now, it was something that came out from Journal of the American Medical Association, I think it was last March, which I also had sent out, where they did studies on these individuals and reported on them. So I sent the copy over to Roy. And again, he being a physician probably can give us greater insight. I really have nothing else new on it. Of course, still curious as to what might be going on. There you go. Back to you.
Very fine, Lou. Yeah, Roy has a healthy skepticism about this. I have a healthy skepticism. And let me give you a few of the words that where my skepticism is coming from. Take high-power microwave energy, and it would have to be microwave because it's the only way you can really focus it with a parabolic dish-like antenna. You can't do very much focusing with a dipole. You couldn't stand across the street with a 80-meter dipole antenna and put multiple kilowatts into it and not have anybody know what the hell you're doing and present enough RF energy to a person in a hotel or in an embassy and give them any grief. So with microwave energy, microwave energy is a wave. We call it RF radiation. It's not radiation. It's an RF wave. That wave penetrates a human being a couple of centimeters into your skin. All of the RF energy that you absorb, if it's on the frequency region where you absorb, and you absorb most between 30 and 300 megahertz, 30 megs and 300 megahertz is where you absorb most. When you go up to the more microwave frequencies, 1500 megs and above, only 20% of the energy goes into your body and becomes absorbed. The 80% reflects off the skin. So, but still, the wave of RF energy, high-power RF energy, penetrates a few centimeters into your skin and creates heating only. They have looked for the non-thermal effect and can't find it. Let me drop. And if you were pulsing that RF energy, if it was really a fierce amount of a very brief pulsed radar-like signals, we'll get the Frey effect, I think it's called Fryer. In other words, this man discovered that you hear an acoustic sound at the pulse rip rate. You hear a clicking sound at the rip rate of the radar. If it's got real high power of the individual pulses and dead time in between, so the average power is something reasonable. You put enough average power into a person where you can do any of these effects, you will feel that heat on your skin and on your face and across your eyes and everything else. You'll feel that heat immediately. I shouldn't have said eyes. The eyes don't have very good temperature sensing. Eyelids, yes. So you will feel that heat. And as you probably know, the military has developed a kind of machine to do crowd control, which is a 94 gigahertz radar-like thing. Let me drop.
Well, the active denial system.
There it is, the active denial system. So you take this antenna that looks like it's around 6 foot square with many kilowatts of 94 gigahertz going into it. It's like a pencil beam coming out of there. And you aim it at a crowd 100 yards away. And the crowd feels heat on their skin immediately, particularly if you are pulsing it. They will feel pulses of heat on their skin. And they want to get themselves away from that immediately. So you have an immediate reaction. So any amount of microwave energy aimed at a human being where it's strong enough in amplitude that it could give any of these effects, you will feel it on your skin immediately. So therefore, all these effects of the of our agents in Cuba and China that they've been experiencing, is it real or is it psychosomatic? Let me drop. And I think I've described to you the psychosomatic effect that occurred in the town of Reims, France, a couple of years ago, where a cell site next to an apartment building was giving people all kinds of grief. And they eventually discovered that the site of the cell site was creating all this grief. It hadn't yet become operational. The antennas were not yet installed. So all these people were developing headaches and nausea and trouble sleeping and trouble concentrating and all kinds of sicknesses and putting tinfoil on the windows to protect themselves. They hadn't put tinfoil hats on their heads yet, but they were putting tinfoil on the windows to try to protect themselves from the RF energy, not realizing that it penetrates the wall pretty well. You know, your cell phone can work in a building that doesn't have any windows in many cases. Roy probably has some further words on this. I'm going to turn it over to Roy right now. AC2GS, and I'm with you on the skepticism, Roy. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hello, Dick. Hello. Are you hearing me well?
A tiny little dropout, but we're hearing you very well. Nice, clean audio. Please proceed.
Okay, I think people are kind of confabulating a few things together and then drawing a conclusion that fortunately isn't based on a lot of good hard evidence. Something might have happened in Cuba. I kind of doubt that it was heavy-duty microwaves, probably some ultrasonic instrument that they bungled and caused the side effects, but that's just conjecture. All these studies come out of Cuba. None of them come out of China, so I think China could very well just be a case of hysteria based on the suspicious goings-on in Cuba. And I think blaming it on the Russians, I think they sort of would like to be blamed. So they're big on misinformation. So I'm not sure what happened. Probably something happened. But drawing a final conclusion that it's the Frey effect and such, I find dubious, especially because one of the pieces of evidence that was provided were recordings of the sounds that people said they heard. And if you could record it, then it's not going on inside your brain.
Okay, something MU, maybe that's QMU, into QMU. Is that you, Bill? Go ahead.
K2MU, Bernie, do you copy, Dick?
K2MU, Bernie, go right ahead, Bernie.
Dick, I got to make a correction, if you will. I asked you this years ago because they put cell towers near me, and you said non-ionizing is totally okay, doesn't even the skin. Turns out that for 30 years, with these fine studies, bioinitiative, on the biological effects done all over the world of microwaves, even at the smallest power of what it does to cells, and the cancer rates are going through the roof near these...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Ask any biologist. There are studies, it's called the Bioinitiative, for 30 years. It turns out the non-ionizing, it's a lobby, like the tobacco lobby, because it's big business. But it's not good for people, and 5G is going to be even worse. And I never thought, I love radio, and I play radio all the time, but these microwaves, the non-ionizing thing is 50 years ago. Now everybody knows the cancer rates are going through the roof where they put these cell towers. That's documented. Look at a million studies online. It's, and just, you know, whatever. I had to throw that in. I'm sure it's controversial, but I did a lot of homework on it, and I couldn't believe what I found. Back to you. This is K2MU.
The good news is that there's a lot of information you can get from the Internet. The bad news is that you've got to now filter that information. 90% of it is good information, and maybe 10% of it is bad. If you search deep enough, you will find zillions of articles of people who claim that the cancer rates of people who live near cell sites are going through the roof. The fact that somebody's website says that does not mean it's really happening. Communication Act of 1995 of the the Federal Communications Commission strongly implies that there is no documented evidence traceable to the Bureau of Standards, that people living as close as you can envision to a cell site have suffered any verifiable biological damage, incidents, whatever. When you study the way the inverse square law works, when you've got that cell phone against your head because you're holding it against your ear, because the cell phone's antenna is a quarter of an inch away from your head, even though it's only radiating milliwatts of power. Let me drop. Even though it's only radiating milliwatts of power, when you study the amount of specific absorption rate, the amount of real RF energy getting into your head from that cell phone against your head, versus living directly next door, as close as you can possibly get. Your bedroom might be on the second floor of a house that's directly next door to a cell site, and your bedroom window faces directly on the cell site. And you make the measurement at rush hour, when all the antennas are turned on. And you then get on, and you make the measurement with good laboratory equipment. And you get in your cell phone, and you report to your friend what you've measured. The amount of signal you get from the cell site, because the closest you can get to it is 200 feet away, and it's quite a number of feet above you. The closest you can get that signal from the cell site is more than 1 million times weaker than the signal you're getting from the cell phone that's in your hand, plus it up against your head. So if anybody is reporting that all these people living near, next to cell sites, where the energy they're getting is more than a million times weaker, and they're developing cancers, you can tell I'm way beyond being skeptical when I hear those kind of pieces of information. By the same token, the people in Bayville, Long Island, let me drop.
May I?
The people in Bayville, Long Island, with all of the antennas removed from their town because they believe the RF radiation is creating cancers in that town. And they've been trying for years to get rid of all the antennas. They can't do that. But they want to do it, and they believe they're suffering all kinds of damage from it. And they had a website that was very active for a while called BRAC, Babel Residents Against Cell Towers, BRACT. And they had gathered all of these very dubious articles that were on the internet telling you that you get cancer from any piece of radio information, your microwave oven's going to give it to you, and your cordless telephone's going to give it to you. They found those articles and collected them all in one spot. All of the articles that are well-documented that say the opposite, none of those articles were on the website. So it was very selective, pick and choose, if you know what I mean. So, Bernie, what evidence do you have that you just told us zillions of people, so to speak, are getting cancer because they live near cell sites? How well-documented do you believe that is? K2 Mike Uniform, the guy who brought this to our attention. K2 LIW. Go ahead, Bernie. I think there was somebody else who said they wanted to make a comment. Who was that? Wait for the beeps. Give us the full call and your name. Go right ahead.
Jim Jack, I with a quick comment.
I heard EJ, and I think I heard Hank with a quick comment. EJ first. Go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, I just did a little bit of searching, and I found something interesting. There's a university in Italy called Amazzini. They did a study on cell phone radiation. The thing that caught my eye is they said that they were finding rare tumors in rats, and they say they studied 2,448 Sprague Dawley rats from pre-natal life to their natural death. To environmental cell tower radiation for 19 hours a day. And here's the kicker. They said it's 1.8 gigahertz GSM radio frequency radiation at 5, 25, and 50 volts per meter. I mean, wow, that's a lot of energy. And don't know of any towers, any cell towers that make that kind of level.
And as bad as that sounds, the old standard used to be 10 milliwatts per square centimeter, which turned out to be, I think it was 190 volts per meter. 190 volts per meter, you could say, is a threshold of alarm. 5, 10, and 25 volts per meter, that's a fairly weak signal. So not a chance. The defining document on this subject for the whole darn United States is the C-95 report. It's called Charlie-95, probably now up to Rev F or something like that. It's a document created by the American National Standards Institute, a subset of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. It is a document that is updated every couple of years. It's a document that's 40 or so years old. It represents the best measurements of the best laboratories and the best institutions in the United States over the last 4 years, 40 years or so, as to what is the effect of RF energy on human beings. It's got a title that's a great big paragraph. You just Google the word C-95 report, American National Standards Institute, ANSI. You'll find it. It's a fairly dense document written in good technical language, but that document is used by the Department of Defense, all of your Air Force, Army, Navy, and Marines, if you know what I mean, and NIOSH and OSHA. It is the defining document for the United States, and you read it and understand it, and then you'll get a duplication of some of the words I just gave you over the last 10 minutes or so. Let me drop.
Well, I'll have to go. Something for a minute.
Okay, I was going to tell you about the equivalent document of other nations. Go right ahead, Bernie. K2MU. You're dropping out, but try to give us some info. K2RIW.
Okay, my holdings are repeated. I'm by the window.
Okay, you try to hold the repeater by being near the window, and you've got to choose a spot. That's not easy to find because the strongest signal you hear when you're receiving and the strongest signal that we hear when you're transmitting is not from the same location because there's a slight difference in the frequencies. So go ahead and try to make a transmission to us, Bernie. K2MU, K2LAW. Location. We got nothing. We heard the word internet once. That's all we heard. So, the place where you hold the handy-talkie for the strongest signal on reception is not the same place as when you transmit to us. There's a better location. Make a very brief transmission at a slightly different location, and let's see if we can hear you. K2MU, K2RIW. Getting nothing from Bernie. That's too bad he was coming through better earlier. Hank, N1YDY. Go right ahead, Hank. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, certainly not as technical as the rest of the discussion, but years ago I put up a tower and an antenna in Norwalk, Connecticut. And before I even hooked the feed line up to the tower, it was a retractable high-gain tower. And every time I tested it, cranked it up just to see if I had the pulleys right and the shims all properly greased and things like that, my neighbor would complain to the town that I was interfering to her telephone and her television. And the town sent an engineer out, and I showed him that I actually didn't even have a feed line yet hooked up to the thing. It's just every time I cranked it up, she called and complained, and when I cranked it back down, she quit complaining. All I'm going to say to this is that it taught me that sometimes what people complain about when they see an antenna has nothing to do with reality. It has to do with their perception of how they can get something they find aesthetically unattractive removed from their sight.
Yeah, that's good information, Hank. And so people really strongly resist change. You put a cell site into a community that previously didn't have one, and the change in what they see on the horizon and their belief that the radio energy coming out of it is going to give them all kinds of grief is enough to trigger all kinds of psychosomatic effects. People coming from Europe to the United States will say, how in the world do you tolerate all that ugliness? They're talking about the utility poles every 150 feet, maybe 30, 40, 50 feet high. All these